Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 280 featuring Matthew Bannister, who is the founder and CEO of D-Box. He is a very cool cat, Really, really nice person as well. He had an archivist company back in the 90s, early 90s. It's kind of an amazing thing that he's talking about. What were some of your thoughts, Kristen, about Matthew?
Oh, well, one, I loved listening to his voice. I could listen to it all day. He's just so relaxing.
Yes, he is.
And like you said, he's been the archivist forever, since the beginning. And so he's seen its like developments and downfalls. And what you guys get into is the social media right now, and some accounts reposting artists' work with no credit given. So Credit Revolution is what he started. Mm-hmm. And you guys go into depth about that. And it's a simple thing to give credit, but it's just not done properly. So
yeah, it's interesting. Yeah. And it's all from Instagram. And it's weird because it's not even like I didn't quite understand. I mean, he did a great job of explaining it. But basically, there's people on Instagram that are just grabbing some beautiful art viz that someone did and just posting it up there without giving any credit just for clicks, because apparently people just click on images on Instagram and these people make money off of just stealing beautiful images and then using them as their Instagram feed. So it's a really weird thing, but really great that he started this and brought light to this, because I think it affects everything. You know, I think this is something that should be really brought to light for everything that's going on. I'm sure photographers are involved in that kind of fight, and certainly ArcViz should be as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And he talks about something else that was kind of interesting, right?
Yeah, so he talks about writes and records his own music, and it's kind of his ongoing therapy. He's been sober now; it'll be 6 years, I believe, in July. Mm-hmm. And we'll have a link to that page. It's called The Beautiful Fear, and make sure I got that right. Mm-hmm. And he'll be releasing a double album this summer, so it's kind of fun.
Yeah. So he's really into music as well, obviously, and it was really kind of nice to talk about that and finding something that helps you sort of deal with some of the traumas that may be going on in your life or the stresses that go on in your life, and to find out how you can deal with that. So all around, it was really nice to talk to Matthew. You know, this was recorded. We did have a video of this. Unfortunately, Matthew's video wasn't working, but Lon was also involved in the conversation. So Lon and I talked to Matthew together. We're going to make a video either way of it. He was really kind of nice because, you know, obviously with, you know, when we recorded this, it was still up about some of the early stages of the coronavirus isolation. And we were all trying to struggle to figure out how to deal with things. And, you know, so he was very nice to sort of bring to light some of the things in his life that help him relax and deal with the stresses of life as well. So it was really cool to have him on. Okay. We got some big announcements. So let's move on to those real quick so we can get to the podcast.
All right. So you can find out about all of our events and news at chaosgroup.com. But the big one is V-Ray 5 for 3DS Max has launched this week. So
that's right.
It'll be like about a week once you've heard about it.
Yes. Yeah. So V-Ray 5 is out for Max, obviously. Others will follow very shortly, but it is out. We've got a lot of new features involved in that, and it's a big, big release. So we're really, really excited about it. Some really amazing things. The big thing you will notice the first time you launch Max is that you will have a completely new frame buffer, and it is really cool. So, but there are also a lot of other features. So just like Kristen said, go to chaosgroup.com to find out more information about V-Ray 5. And V-Ray 5 for Maya beta is out too, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right. Okay. So if you're on Maya and you're wondering, well, the beta is out, so you guys can definitely get the beta and try it out as well. And all the other ones will be following shortly after that. But we have one other very interesting announcement that came out this week or last week for this when this comes out. What was it?
So it is our V-Ray collection. Yep. You can get V-Ray, Phoenix FD, Project Lavina, Chaos Cloud, and VR scans in a single collection.
That's right. And that's a really cool. We get basically all the V-Rays, all the Phoenixes, Project Lavina, VR scans, and you get some cloud credits as well to bundle it all together for one low price for the year. So you can go check that out. So check out the V-Ray collections on our site. It's pretty interesting to see what's available in your site. You can buy it directly from us, or you can buy it through a reseller. It doesn't matter to us either one. We would love for you to experience all the V-Rays, all the Phoenixes. So that's a big deal. V-Ray collections, check it out on our site. And if people want to know more about our podcast, where should they go?
You can go to facebook.com/cggaragepodcast or chaosgroup.com/cggarage.
That's right. And of course, if you want to have, if you have any ideas of other guests you'd like to have on, let us know, labs@chaosgroup.com. We'd also love to get ratings and reviews from you on our Apple Podcast page as well. So make sure you give us a rating and review there. Share it with all your friends. And of course, remember, we are now also available on YouTube. So just go to the Chaos Group TV channel on YouTube and you can check out all the video versions of this podcast. Of course, you can also get it on our Facebook page, like we said earlier as well. So all of that is available and we would love to hear more from you, the audience. All right. That being said, please enjoy this fantastic podcast with Mr. Matthew Bannister.
Welcome to another CG Garage where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
Well, this is awesome that you're able to be on and that we're able to talk about a lot of cool stuff. It is a strange new world that we're living in. We're all acknowledging that. But we're trying to be opportunistic and find out new ways of doing things, new ways of doing business, new ways of connecting to people, new ways of hanging out and podcasting. But we've obviously wanted to do a podcast for a while with you, based on a new initiative that you have, which is the Credit Revolution, right?
Oh, that's right, yeah.
Before we get into that, we need to give our audience a little bit of context and know a little bit about you and about your company. And, you know, actually, I also want to let you know that I had Mike Golden on as well not long ago, and he was singing your praises.
He's a lovely bloke. We're good friends.
Yeah. He's a really good guy. So, give us a little context about where you come from. How did you end up, doing the things you do and, you know, heading up D-Box and stuff?
Where do I start? It goes back to college. I studied architecture up at Cornell. And I was there in the kind of the early 90s.
Okay.
And it was a time when I ended up there a little bit late. I went to art school before I ended up in architecture school, and I was in a band for a little bit. So I was probably 3 or 4 years older than my classmates.
Right. I was at Colgate in between 89 and 93. So that we were in the same neck of the woods.
Yeah. I mean, I think if I'd gone straight to Cornell out of high school, I would have ended up there in the fall of 85, but I messed around a bit and it took me a while to get up to Cornell. But at the time there's a character called Don Greenberg, who's kind of the godfather of computer graphics.
Yeah.
And over at the Theory Center, he was kind of programming and building things for us to play with.
Yeah.
And myself and a couple of colleagues, friends, played pretty hard with them, and we got into this kind of exciting 3D world. And I guess because we were architecture students, we tried to figure out maybe how to ultimately turn that into something that we could do.
Yeah.
As a kind of a business model, it didn't really exist there. Although there probably were, at the time when we were in college, there might have even been some firms that had even started up. I know Hayes Davidson started very early, but we probably weren't aware of them at the time. You know, I don't have a great memory anymore. So
right, yeah.
We reconvened in New York and needed to pay some bills.
Yeah,
and we were the three of us were in a band at the time. And you know, I'd been to graduate school at Princeton. We ended up in the back of the Princeton Architectural Press offices. The Kevin Lippert, who owns Princeton Architectural Press, I'd gone and visited him. He was a professor at Princeton. I'd visited him, and I noticed he had a kind of a broom closet in the back of his office that I figured the three of us could fit into. So I kind of asked him if we could potentially fit in there, and that's how we started.
Wow.
And it was strange times, because there was not really a market for architectural visualizations.
Right.
No, there isn't. There wasn't back then. I mean, this must have been what, 94, 95, or
this was like 95, 90, 96.
Okay. Yeah.
By the time it was 96 by the time we made it, and we like registered it as an official business, but we were already probably kind of beginning to poke around a little earlier than that.
Yeah. I was at Colgate for my undergraduate, but then I went to Rice, and I graduated in 97, and the visualization was definitely something, but the idea of a company that would only do visualization was unique.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, there was in architecture, I think that London sort of turned it into a profession before the US did.
Right.
So, you know, I mean, I think that it's one of those things that it's not like, I don't like to, people say, oh, pioneers and all that. It's just, you know, whatever. We were just, the technology was becoming available, and we were curious, like other people were in other parts of the world. And
yep,
lots of other people started doing similar things, and we ended up being D-Box, and they ended up being something else.
Right. Yeah, D-Box was definitely something I remember during that time. You know, seeing some of the work that you guys were working on was influential, and definitely started the idea of what if things were visualized and people thought about the story. That was something that I think was unique that you guys are doing, is you were thinking about story before anyone else was, in terms of what you were trying to convey. You're not just saying, here's what it's going to look like. It's like, in this image, I'm actually telling a story. And that's, you know, obviously that's a skill that the photographers have used for years, but something that I don't think people realize. They get wrapped up in the technology and then forget about what they're trying to actually show, right?
Yeah. Thank you for noticing that at the time, but that was something that really fascinated us. I mean, the idea of the name, actually Dialogue Box, which is what we were called, was the idea of kind of narrative, interactive narrative.
Right.
At least that's what it meant to us at the time. We taught a course up at Cornell that we called Dialogue Box, and that morphed into D-Box.
Right.
But yeah, it was just the idea of representing architecture was not, I don't think that was enough. That was enough for us. So we did try and sneak in other things, right, through photography. And it was a lot of work at the time.
Right.
You know, photography had to be kind of scanned, and, you know, right, this was to get other objects and to get people and people doing things in visuals was quite a challenge in the way that it obviously isn't now. I mean, I've got remarkable 3D people drinking coffee, walking around that, to my old eyes, look real.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. But I mean, I think, you know, when it started in those days, it was, I mean, Lon and I always joke about, people would make, you know, first things like, I'm going to do an animation. And what they would do is make a 1,000 frame timeline, make a spline that walks through the entire space and make the camera follow the spline. It was a horrible, horrible experience.
And you would have clients come to you, and they would use a term like fly through.
Right.
Which I guess that word was a kind of a construct of the idea that you would be pulled by your nose. Right. Endlessly through a space, bashing through doors and
yep,
into elevators and coming out the other, like there was very little desire to do something cinematic.
Right.
And I remember there was an early project that we did for Diller and Scafidio, which was their, I can't remember if it was their competition entry for iBeam, which was mm-hmm, that museum. And the idea that we had for that was actually split screen, split screen of multiple cameras moving through spaces slightly separated, so you got an alternate perspective on a scene. And of course, right, the characters in the animation were actually just still cutouts. And it was right, incredibly primitive. But that was, I think that was the first time we tried to do something which was thinking about cinema. Multiple right, camera angles portraying a moment in time. Right. Yeah.
We used to tease people about strapping them to a two-wheel cart and then wheeling them through a hallway. Like, here, let me show you what the camera move is going to look like. Hop onto this, you know, wheelbarrow, and, yeah, and we'll show you.
Yeah.
It was exciting times. We did feel like, I think sometimes we felt like we were exploring something. I'm sure it's like that for young people coming into the profession today. Maybe I'm just sort of, I'm a bit old and cynical now. Nothing. I mean, even when I see something that's incredibly new, I unfortunately, it seems that it's always a reference to something that's probably been done before.
Yeah. There were some moments, right? There were moments that were sort of paradigm shifts in the idea of what things look like and how they can look like, right? And those redefined the whole profession, right? We started with, well, okay, now I know I can fly through or go through the space. And that turned out to be the wrong answer. But it also was the beginning of us thinking about walking through a space, right? Mm-hmm. In that before it existed. So at least that was something that happened. But and then there was the idea of story. And then there was the idea of people and, you know, and green screens, right? And people suddenly inventing a little bit more narrative and having music that made sense, you know? And then when I went to SIGGRAPH in 2007, was it seven? Yeah.
Yep. San Diego.
And I saw the stuff, you know, what Jeff Muddle was showing, you know, the work from companies like, you know, like D-Box, obviously, but also Neoscape and Uniform and all those guys. And I was like, oh my God, ArcViz has changed drastically. I mean, I was in visual effects at that time, so I was kind of a little bit out of touch. It's like so much has changed. People are using green screens and architecture rendering. As like, it just, that was something I just didn't know that they and anyone would actually go that far.
Yeah, I mean, it's always been a challenge because you in order to get there, you also it's a massive marketing challenge because you have to talk clients into spending the appropriate amount of money for you to be able to do things properly.
Right. And helicopter shoots or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. And you know, over time, the client's point of reference has, you know, they've become, there was a time that clients would look at a computer rendering and they would be stunned by the fact that it reminded of them of something that was maybe photographic, and they thought that we were magicians.
Right.
Now, clearly that's all gone away because, you know, there was a period when there was definitely a shift in the client's perception of what we could do. And I would call it the avatar moment, where suddenly clients were, they wanted to do it in 3D too. And then it was just like, wait a second, this is, you know, we had many requests. Can we do this in 3D, you know, with 3D goggles? And we were kind of like, well, yeah, we could, but where's the money coming from? So there was kind of a massive valley between what was possible and what we wanted to do and actually what clients were willing to pay. But that's changed quite a bit. I think that there are clients today that understand that there's real value in telling real stories.
Right.
And in order to tell real stories with real people, it's quite a production and it requires real money.
Yeah. That's true. I'm actually pretty impressed by what clients will pay now. They didn't seem to want to pay that before, you know, and they will pay for a helicopter shoot and, they will pay for those things because, you know, through pioneers like yourselves, you guys did it and showed that there was value in it. And then they want to do it again. Then they'll spend money for it, right? Because if you're going to say, I want money for a helicopter shoot, but they've never seen anyone actually do that, they're not going to be reluctant to say, that's really expensive for something I've never, I don't know what I'm going to get, you know?
Yeah, it's sort of happened so slowly that you're reminding me you're taking me back here, but I'm remembering how incrementally those steps were, right. The point at which there was a time in which we would work with a photographer to do mm-hmm. the back plates, and he would scan these things, and then that became cumbersome, and then we needed to do the photography, so we had to learn photography, but then we needed to charge the clients for that, and then that was kind of like, well, you know, we have to pay for the photography, and is it, well, yes, we're not going to make a computer model of the whole city to put your building in, right?
Right.
And then it gets to the helicopter, and then the green screen. It's just been a kind of a sort of a slowly getting clients used to the idea that in order to create those powerful visuals that hopefully travel around the world, create public awareness and add value to a project and tell a story, that it costs money. And I sense there's still, you know, to get into this profession and to get to the kind of the bigger clients, I fear that there's a lot of firms that actually absorb that cost themselves, and they shouldn't, because the clients do have the money,
right?
They are willing to pay for it. They do know what it costs,
and they're just taking advantage of them at that point.
Yes, if you're willing to do it for free, they will smile and pretend that's normal,
right?
And I was always interested in how different markets were different, right? So in a place like New York, you have people pushing the envelope. Helicopter shoots come out a lot earlier because it makes sense. You've got to be in the air to do that. But, you know, you go to some place like, I don't know, Chicago or Kansas City or something like that, and it's a wildly different dynamic there, and the market's maybe not as competitive. They hadn't kind of caught up. So there are these pockets of, you know, people that were really kind of pushing the envelope, and New York was one of those areas, maybe London. Then, of course, even later on, you know, you got places in the Middle East that, that sort of really broke things wide open. But they've been these little pockets of pioneers that really sort of pushed the envelope to, you know, where you are now.
Hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I think, there was, I don't know when Third and Seventh came out. That was another big watershed moment for people that were doing visualization.
Yeah, amazing. What I can't remember the year.
I think it was 2010.
Yeah, it's 2010, 2011, I want to say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what was interesting about that is that was something that, I brought it up before, but it was something that basically, when he did that, it got everyone's attention. And at that point, anyone who did architecture visualization, that was their reference from then on, to like, I have to make it look at least as good as that. But it also influenced non-architects. I remember people in the visual effects mm-hmm. world that just, it's like, what the hell was that? And what do you mean that's just one guy?
I remember at the time thinking to myself, how?
Right.
How did one guy, how many computers does he have at his, how, it's such a beautiful, I haven't watched it in a while, but I imagine it still probably really holds
up. Still stunning. It's still stunning.
It's gorgeous. It falls into that category for me, though, there's the kind of the industry, if you want to call it the industry of architectural visualization. Mm-hmm. And there's the work that doesn't have clients, and then there's the work that has clients.
Yep.
And I very much separate those two in my mind.
Yes, and you're right to do so.
Yeah. It's a very different world.
Mm-hmm.
I do things creatively that have no clients, and it's very, very important. Mm-hmm. And I recognize that that's different than working for clients.
Yeah,
not to take anything away from what he did, because it's like the finest piece, but he
did something important, right? He did a piece of architecture that he admired, and then he was going to show it in a unique way. Mm. And he showed it, and he did all the things that clients would never ask you to do, right? Yeah. He did things like show close-ups of things and things out of focus. And
yeah, it was the big depth of field moment.
The big depth of field moment. Yeah. Huge depth of field moment.
Beautiful. We haven't recovered.
No, we haven't recovered for that. And that's a thing, right? It was kind of like there was that, oh my God, now we need to tell, you know, we have to tell stories of architecture instead, right? And that sort of, to me, was the first thing that's like, architecture visualization has a role that goes beyond the architecture itself. It's telling a story of the narrative, right? And so that's something that I thought was important. And then we had production values went up, and it was like, you are dealing with actual production here. You know, you got casting and sound. And
I mean, it's interesting to look back at that, because I think that in many ways he put kind of a stamp down that I think many of us followed, and that was the idea that that it would be a photographic language.
Yes, and clearly it's about photography.
It's clear. Yeah, it's very much about. I think that there's. It's interesting that still seems to be the predominant pursuit. I mean, it's a question that I grapple with. I think a little bit about this, and that is, you know, there's the kind of the visual whereby there's things within the visual that clearly cue that it's mimicking a photograph.
Right.
Something as simple as, let's say, exposure.
Okay. Yep.
So there's a window and the window is blown out. So the window is, everything outside the window is kind of white and blown out. And that's basically saying I am mimicking a photograph.
Right. Right.
Whereas it's kind of interesting because a painter wouldn't paint that way. And our eyes don't actually don't see that way. It's a very, I'm thinking that maybe that Roman's piece might have been the moment that architectural visualization for the most part followed a photographic trajectory. Of course, there were others that didn't. I mean, you know, the great work of Eric at Luxagon, who didn't follow a photographic trajectory.
Right.
Or someone like Dennis Allane, who is, you know, there's still a watercolor approach, you know, even though it's a digital.
But in some ways that's mimicking another art as opposed
true.
To kind
yeah,
of finding,
exactly.
its, finding its own
finding its own.
It's an interesting niche. Debate.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting to think about the moods that are set, right? Because there was a mood that was set in there that was interesting. And the other thing that I thought was fabulous about his piece that I think everyone subconsciously realizes that there are stories to be told without people in them, right? Mm-hmm. And those were really great stories. I think, you mean, what's...
there was a character in it, though, wasn't there?
He's in it. He himself is the photographer. So he makes some appearances with a tripod or, you know, being located in the back. So it's not completely devoid of people, but it's only in a few select shots.
Right. Yeah. Which also is a clever thing to do. The other thing is, you know,
to get around the limitations of, you know, having to do full green screen and
And like, how can I tell the story with the least amount of things, least obstructions possible, right? Physical cameras and good rendering and good lighting choices are choices that are not technically challenging. They are artistically challenging, but not necessarily technically challenging. And so that he embraced as many of those as possible to accentuate his talents and not necessarily get bogged down in the green screens and the
I need to watch it again because it's been many years since I watched it. I mean, I kind of remember it as a love letter to architecture.
Yeah,
and photography. That's true. It's a simultaneous love letter to architecture and photography through the, and I guess computer visualization at the same time.
Yeah.
Every few years I give a little presentation about, you know, a brief history of visualization, whether it's, you know, part of the museum exhibition that you guys helped with that we had here in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
You know, where we kind of catalog this, you know, now it's getting on 25 years almost even more if you go back to just, you know, the original kind of 3D wireframes in the late 70s and 80s and some of those. But I'm always amazed when you show some of these seminal pieces now to somebody who might be, you know, just starting and they haven't seen it. They haven't seen it. Or the one that really, like, you know, I shed a tear for was the, you know, Joe Kaczynski and those guys with KD Labs, some of their early work in, you know, the year 2000. You know, you show the desert house and, you know, which is maybe one of the first explorations I've seen of architectural visualization and a handheld idea and so on. And, you know, people are like, what is that?
Yeah.
Like, oh no, we're,
like old farts.
I know, right? Yeah, exactly.
Be careful.
So maybe it's not even relevant anymore. It's like, oh man, we don't.
Well, let's bring up something that is relevant, because I think obviously we've established that there's been a long, you know, there's a long history of architecture visualization, and these are moments that are very important that we've learned, and and it's become, you know, an integral part of the world. And one of the things, you know, we mentioned at the beginning was the Credit Revolution initiative. And this is something obviously you and I think Jeff Muddle is also pretty passionate about as well. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit and let us know, you know, what is that initiative and explain why it exists?
Oh, it was not something I really set out to do. It was, I was a late adopter to social media.
Okay.
And, I mean, I do run the D-Box Instagram. And so I got my head around it, but there was one particular weekend where I'd found our work on a particular Instagram, and I realized that the Instagram was actually another, you know, architectural visualization companies.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of posted under the guise of inspiration.
Right.
I thought, that's interesting. Not sure if I like that. That looks a bit iffy to me. Okay. And this, you know, this Instagram had a massive amount of followers.
Right.
And so that weekend, I just kind of spent the entire weekend kind of going through Instagram. Once clicking on hashtags, I could slowly start working the web,
right?
Like
the literal web, or more literal.
The literal web. I kind of webbed out, and
right.
And I started to see there was real patterns. That there was many Instagrams that were posting others' work, with intentionally hiding the credit, or in some cases, no credit. And it was blatant to me that they were basically building an audience off the back of other people's work. And then there was the Instagram aggregators that were also intentionally hiding credits. And I just thought, F this. Mm-hmm. I've got to do something. I have to do something immediately.
Right.
And so, you know, at first I raised it as a question on my own personal Facebook page. I was just like, is this okay? And other people said, you know, other people chimed in and said, no, it's not okay. And then, just in kind of a flip it moment, I said, well, the credit revolution has begun.
Right.
I spent zero time thinking about that name, and it's a silly name, but it worked. Because right. If I called it something more sensible, it probably would have drifted under people's radar.
Right.
And got the message out. You know, Jeff, of course, was immediately on board. He saw this. And we just saw that there was a lot of characters taking advantage of other people's work, but there was an enormous amount of characters that had just resigned to the fact that that's the way it is.
Right.
And... you know, we've always fought for our credit because that's incredibly important. I mean, as artists and studios, if we're not credited for the work, then I mean, where is our signature in that? What is the value right. of what is the value right. of any art if you can't find the provenance of it?
Right.
You can't. I mean, I've used this as an example. Is, you know, would you take your children to a museum where the art was not credited, where they could not study the artists, where they couldn't right. cross-reference the art, or even, yeah, of course you wouldn't. So. Right. I mean, I think that for me, it's about the value, because collectively as a massive group of studios and artists working, you know, solo artists working for themselves, whether, you know, like a Mike Golden, if it becomes normal for the work not to be credited or just appropriated by somebody else to just basically advertise themselves, then I can just see that kind of the value of the entire industry just falling off a cliff. It just becomes yeah. free. It becomes nothing.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, as long as I've known you, which is, you know, a while now, I think this is even some of the first conversations we ever had were about making sure that people were taking credit seriously. And I remember, you know, one example that you had given at the time because of the experience you had working with, you know, photographers and doing photography yourself, is that photographers seem to have that down pat where they, you know, get a copyright credit for their image, and it's part of their contracts, and it's part of how they negotiate and so on. And, you know, that was a real eye-opening concept in the early days of visualization, but so important. And now, you know, here we are where the ability to broadcast any image is infinite and can happen, you know, so quickly. So when I know when I saw it, I was very happy to see that so many people had gotten excited about it. And, you know, from our end, you know, as somebody who curates a lot of other people's images, say for the gallery, for, you know, for Chaos and for other things, like one of the things that, and the demo reels and so on, one of the things that we've ingrained and continue to ingrain in people is how important it is to make sure that the credit is there for people, and that it's never missed, and that it's accurate, right? So
yeah.
It's, you know, it's something that we take very seriously as much as we can, to make sure that credit, you know, to give credit where credit
but
is.
What is the incentive? Like, what's the incentive of people to not credit other people?
I think it's easy. I mean, Matthew can answer this better than I can, but I think it's real easy just to say, here's an image courtesy of whoever emailed it to you. Right. You know, if you're a trade publication, if you're a publication or yeah.
It's just it's because social is this kind of insatiable monster of content. It's created an incredible laziness.
Yeah.
And when you mix that with some pretty disingenuous strategy, the characters with disingenuous strategy can hide behind the sort of the global laziness. And what I mean by laziness is you have these Instagrams, they might be called Worldwide Architecture Luxury or some horseshit name like that.
right.
And they'll post two buildings, two architectures, and they'll say, A or B, choose your one, right? And it'll be two photographs of two pieces of architecture, and the audience of 1.2 million people will choose which one their favorite one is. And nobody will question, well, what is it? Who made it? It's not right. just, it's, you know, this is not just an architectural visualization problem. This is
a design.
This yeah. is a, yeah, this is everybody's problem. So there's that right. there's that laziness going on, right? There's massive Instagrams that basically just post other people's stuff and nobody cares. all they want is just to see another image as they, you know, as they blister their thumb south, right?
Right.
and then you have characters who have a disingenuous strategy, and that is like they go, okay, so I can take this stuff that's similar to my stuff, and I can use all of your stuff on my Instagram to build a following, and then I can link off my Instagram to actually what I've got for sale.
Right.
And that's where I wanted to step in and make it, because at D-Box, I mean, we do pretty well for getting credit. We get credit, and, you know, we have strict contracts. Our clients understand that we are the copyright holders. We get credit. It's you know, the credit revolution was about, as quickly as possible, letting as many people in our industry know that this is not okay.
Right.
You have to stand up for yourself. And it's not, you have to resist that temptation. Your work might get posted on an Instagram that has lots of followers, and you might just like the attention of it being up there, even though your credit is buried.
Or not
included in at all. But you need to, you know, you need to step up and say, no, that's not okay. You can't. And there's a massive misconception too, is most people that I've talked to believe that if the credit's in there somewhere, then they haven't violated your copyright. And it's, I mean, it's, right. It's actually, you know, for
you still have to get permission.
Exactly. And yeah. So it's an attempt, and I mean, it's a kind of the credit revolution is an ad hoc movement that I wish I had more time to devote to, but I think got off to a great start, and then I became very busy over the new year, and then this thing called COVID-19 came along,
right?
And so it's been a little sidetracked. I mean, the next thing that, I mean, actually Mike and I are working on currently is a series of posts, which are the combination of kind of our contract, the D-Box contract, and the contract that Mike uses, and going through those contracts to explain to as many people who want to listen as to how we actually conduct business to ensure that we do get credit and that we are protected. So it's not just about, I mean, it's called the credit revolution. It's not just about getting credit. It's
educating people on how to do it.
It's an attempt to educate people how to conduct themselves as a proper business in this industry, because my belief is that, and Jeff's belief is, and the other characters that have helped me in this, is our belief that if we can't all, the industry is growing so rapidly that there's kind of a critical mass that, through accepting a bunch of practices, is pulling everybody down.
Right.
And I actually, I don't see, I'm not very optimistic for the industry if we can't take the wheel back.
But I'm always, every time, you know, someone says something bad happened and it's on the internet, right? And so I always think there was a hilarious, before Joe Rogan became the podcast sensation that he is today, he was an actor in a show called News Radio, and that on the show that someone was like, oh no, something bad is on the internet, and this is in the early days of the internet, and goes, Joe, you're take it off, and he says, I can't take it off, it's on the internet. That's like trying to take pee out of a pool. You can't do it.
No kidding.
Right? So how do you take it off? How do you stand up for your rights? If it's everywhere, everywhere.
That's a really good question. I focused largely on Instagram, and I went around and I cleaned up all of the big ones. I actually the architecture visualization studios that were posting other people's work through many back and forths convinced them that the right thing to do was to turn what they had done into an aggregator and to start their own Instagram for their own business, to separate the two. And we were very successful at doing that. And the way that we did that is I would reach out to the characters and start a dialogue until in most cases they, you know, they could be convinced if I met a wall where basically they were just telling me to you know, mind my own business. Mm-hmm. I would then CC in about 50 other leading characters in the industry and said, hey, you know, we're all in this together. And then through persuasive conversation, and we kept it clean, everybody realized that actually this is a wave that is moving and we're not going to stop. We're not going to back off. Right. You know, the large Archviz aggregators, you know, some of them to begin with was like, well, you know, we don't have to put the credits in the first line. But pretty quickly they caught on. And once we turned a couple of them, they suddenly realized that they actually was a better idea to be doing the right thing than the wrong thing.
Right.
It makes them look better, makes everybody look better. But going back to your question is, once somebody's peed in the pool, how do you get the pee out of the pool? That's very tricky. I mean, there's, you know, you can have somebody, let's say you produce an image for an iconic project in New York, which is on the skyline and it's a skyscraper, and somebody just takes your image and then they decide to add other skyscrapers to that because they think that's a fun thing to do without asking your permission. Then mm-hmm. they post that on an Instagram, and then that gets shared across a whole bunch of other Instagrams. Like, how do you get that pee out of the pool? Because what that's done is it's taken your image, which actually had some value, and marked a period of in time when you launched a certain project, and suddenly there's all these other versions out there with fantasy architecture. That's a problem. And yeah. You know, we've had that happen a couple of times, and it's just, you know, it can be some random young person in a country far, far away that had never dawned on them that actually the background image they were using was actually owned by somebody. Mm-hmm. And once it gets shared, it's hard to get it off the internet.
Right.
So,
but I'm wondering, I don't know if you guys had looked into this, but I'm wondering, is there a way to digitally watermark things, right? And if let's say you can digitally watermark that image that you did where you can't see it in some way, but somehow it's embedded in the file, and no matter how many times you save over, that digital watermark stays in some ways. Can you then do that and then, you know, web crawl the internet and find versions of that image?
I believe there is technology only around the corner that's going to try and solve this problem. It's going to wreak havoc on a platform like Instagram because all the you know, many of the large Instagrams at least work in the visual space. And that, what I mean is by that is there's large Instagrams, which are basically famous people, whether they're famous for a good reason or famous just because they're famous, and they post their everyday life, right? And that's you know, they have multiple millions, maybe they're athletes or whatever they are. And then there's these other Instagrams which tend to be visuals, which are kind of collections of travel moments or whatever, just randomly grab other people's stuff, and they are massively profiteering off other people's IP.
Right.
And
I don't think Instagram is going to want to stop them because they're getting rich off of them anyway, right?
Exactly. So I think, you know, I'd like to think that we're going to reach a moment where that can't happen anymore.
Right.
And that stuff will get pulled down. And there may be a time in the future whereby, you know, people will be they'll be sent like sort of speeding tickets through the mail.
Have you actually, you know, have you guys approached like the press about this? Because, you know, honestly speaking, I think a site like The Verge, they would love this. They would love this story. It would be a very, very big story for them. Because they do talk about social media a lot. They talk about issues that happen in those areas. We should talk because I follow The Verge constantly. Lon knows I'm always talking about The Verge. And I'm always talking about, they have some really good podcasts as well. There's something called The Verge Cast, which is all about their technology. But Ashley Carman is one of their reporters, and she does another podcast called Why'd You Push That Button, which is a really good one. And it's a lot of it is about, you know, choices that are made in social media or different things of that nature.
It's the wild, it's the absolute wild west at the moment.
But I think that if you brought it to their awareness, we could reach wilder, a wider audience of awareness. Right. And I think that everyone would say, yeah, that is wrong. Right. Yeah. And they would question the sites that they're looking at. They're like, oh, wait a minute. I remember that podcast that I listened to on The Verge about that. And now I'm just sitting here looking at pictures of architecture, realizing, wait a minute, who did this? Right. And there, I don't think people are aware that they're looking at that.
I saw this one today and I thumbed onto it. I can't remember what it was. And it was two videos, one of which was this beautiful funicular, outdoor funicular that was kind of dropping into a valley, I believe somewhere in Switzerland. Mm-hmm. And it was a video. And then there was another, you know, if you swiped to the right, there was another video, which was this beautiful stairway that was leading down into this cove somewhere, maybe in the Mediterranean. And mm-hmm. the text that went with it is like, which one's yours? And I'm just like, and I went through all the comments and nobody asked like, where the F is this? What is it?
Right.
You know, it's just like, maybe people just don't care. But I kind of, I care not only where those two places are, but I kind of care who took the video for both of them as well.
Right.
And yep. in the process of doing all this, I mean, it's made me very aware of what I post too, because I post things that, I mean, I, you know, I might post a John Singer Sargent painting or something, or
right.
maybe it's David Bowie's birthday and I will post a picture of David Bowie on my Instagram and say, happy birthday, David Bowie, or
right.
or something like that, crediting the photographer. But it's also made me very conscious about, you know, I didn't ask, you know, Mick Rock's permission to post that photograph of David Bowie, and I probably should have. So there is, you know, it's a very interesting topic. And, you know, I'm waiting for somebody to point the finger at me and say, look, you posted somebody else's thing. But I think there's a bit of a difference there between an Instagram, which has like 2 million followers, and just blatantly one post after the other has no regard. It's not like they're posting a John Singer Sargent painting and saying, look at this beautiful painting by John Singer Sargent. And this composition is interesting for this reason. They're just posting other people's photography and making a ton of cash from it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that's, and when I say Instagram, I'm not meaning the D-Box Instagram, obviously. I'm just meaning my personal one.
Right. No, I think that's a brilliant thing. And I think people should be made aware of it. I don't actually, you know, cause I'm an old fuddy duddy. Myself, I don't go on Instagram that much, you know.
Yeah, well, good for you. I mean, I'd give up if everybody else did. I just,
you know, the thing is, what's
being left behind?
What's really, I know. What's really, I mean, I don't. I'm sometimes on Facebook a little bit, and Twitter. I seem to be a little bit more active on these days, but Instagram is just not the thing for me. But everyone keeps telling me, is like, oh, well, Instagram is so much more gratifying, right? Instagram is there to relax people or make people happy because they see pretty images or whatever, right? It's not there to be massively political like the way Facebook has and Twitter has turned into sometimes.
It's a nummifier. It's like a dormal.
Right.
What is a dormal in America? Is that a word in America? Dormal.
What is a dormal?
I don't know. It's what a baby sucks on. A pacifier.
Right.
Like just that thumbing vertically and seeing something different over and over again. It can kind of numb you into this place where you forget about the real world. And it's designed exactly to do that. I mean, the reason I resisted Instagram for so long to begin with is it looks so pointless to me. You know, the format is so ugly for displaying art anyway. It's got no canvas. It's got all these icons that surround stuff. And that's probably very purposefully engineered. It's not supposed to look beautiful.
Okay. Well, let me ask you a question then, because I'm going to because I've been thinking about it. As you said, maybe I'm guilty of the same thing. But I want your opinion on this. I have another podcast I do called Martini Giant with two of my friends. And we talk about movies that we love, right? Or mostly they're very funny podcasts because we're pretty joking kind of people. But what we like to do is we take stills from the movies that we talk about and we put ourselves in the stills in a comic way. And that becomes part of our podcast that we do.
Yeah.
And then we post those on Instagram, obviously. But, you know, if I'm going to, you know, there's a still, an obvious still from Ferris Bueller's Day Off, for example. And I am inside the shot with Ferris Bueller. Is that, how do you feel about that? How does that, I mean, because it's obviously Ferris Bueller's Day Off. And the whole point is that I'm in the shot.
Yeah, that's the humor of it. That's a very good question. I mean, it, you know, in that case, it's like, I suppose the people that own, you know, that own the rights to that film could have exception to it. I think it's pretty clear what it is. It kind of falls into a little bit of fair use collage.
Parody, yeah.
Well, it's parody. It's definitely parody. It's
definitely parody. And I think that there's all sorts of laws to protect a sense of humor.
Right.
And I think it's very clear what it is. But yeah, I mean, it's, I can see why you're asking me that question. So and I don't really have a good answer for you.
Because I didn't really think about it until you started bringing it up. I was like, oh, well, we did it because it's funny, right? And it cracks people up every time they see it. And yes, there is, obviously parody is something that's important, but I am curious, you know, like, what does that mean? You know,
it's a very good question. And I don't profess to have the answer to this mad equation that we're in at all. I do. You know, the credit revolution was born out of the idea that I do not think it's acceptable for an architectural visualization company to be posting another architectural visualization company's work.
Oh my God, no.
Under the guise of inspiration to gather followers.
Wow.
It's, you know.
So nefarious.
Yeah. And then there's kind of levels of nefariousness. And I mean, you know, we even categorize them as a kind of a type one, type two, type three, type four, to kind of go through the various kind of levels of crime, let's say.
Yeah.
But I don't profess to have the answers to this.
Right.
I think that the goal here was there's a massive amount of people entering this industry, the industry that I'm proud to be a part of, that I want them to question where their work ends up. And I want them to demand to get credit in a visible way to solve the much bigger issue of copyright and Instagram. That's beyond my ability, clearly.
Right. Yeah.
And I can't even answer your very good question there. Because part of me wants to say, no, you've been a very bad boy. Lon, get the handcuffs out. We're going to take Chris away now. And then part of me wants to just say, well, it's parody. It's fine, you know? And again, I mean, I'm the one who's just talking about posting Mick Rock photographs of David Bowie on my own Instagram, wishing him a happy birthday, and he's dead. You know,
right.
So there's levels of gray area.
Right. Absolutely.
I'm not innocent.
No. I mean, well, I'm not, I don't know how innocent or guilty you are, but I can say that you bring up an excellent point that I think that we should all be aware of those things, right? And whether you're innocent or guilty doesn't change the points that you're making, right?
Yeah, I guess.
And so I think that those are excellent ideas and that, yeah, you know, I don't think D-Box is going out there posting a bunch of pictures from, you know, Neoscape and Mir and Uniform saying, check out our amazing architecture visualization tools, you know, or whatever.
Yeah, no, it's, I mean, that would be unheard of.
Right.
Back in the day, back in the Renaissance, or was it the Middle Ages when we started all of this?
Yeah,
definitely Middle Ages.
Right. And, you know, and I think that of course, and I totally respect people that are like quarter my age, and the fact that they grew up with social media and that all of this seems acceptable. But I, you know, the whole idea with the credit revolution is to hopefully get the kind of a younger generation that are coming into the profession just to take pause and think, wait, maybe it's good that I put my foot down and I start to really insist credit everywhere. And I've tried to instill in everybody that if you make sure you get credit, you don't really have to do marketing for your service. If your work is good and you get credit, the phone will ring.
Right.
And as commercial artists, everybody needs that to happen all the time. I think that some people are you know, a lot of people that have come into our profession since the last recession, when and the phone has rang a lot in the last 10 years. And yeah. And this awful situation we're in right now is perhaps for some the first example of where the phone actually stops ringing for a bit. And mm-hmm. having credit out there actually helps in times like this.
Right. And if people are stealing that from you. Yeah. If people are stealing that from you. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's the credits are what helped the cream rise to the top. Right. So.
Well, I mean, I think it just puts value. I mean, when I see a great piece of work by another architectural visualization company, if I see an image and I don't know what the credit is, I can't see it, it infuriates me. It just makes me mad because I want to know who did it. And I want to know who did it in case I run into them at D2 on something, because I want to go up to them and I want to say, hey, that particular image, that was, wow, that blew my head off. But the idea that there's so much work, there was so much work. I mean, if we rewind only 6 months, there was so much Archviz work floating around that was uncredited. It's changed a lot. What we did, it didn't fix everything, but it definitely worked a lot.
Right.
People credit now, and the credit's visible. It's not buried below the third line, which is the other thing that everybody was doing.
Right.
To gain followers, because if you're an aggregator that's pulling other people's visuals, and you post it with hashtags, and then if in the first line you have follow your Instagram, if somebody from another comes to your Instagram because they've come across it from the hashtag, they will follow your Instagram instead of following the creator of the artwork. So insisting that everybody moved the credit up to the first line really helped everybody else get a fair shake of being recognized.
Right. It's interesting. Such a simple thing, right?
It's such a simple thing, but it's you know, that one weekend where I basically spent, you know, 20 hours going through Instagram, I saw very strategic patterns with many large Instagrams where it was incredible. I realized it all made sense to me how purposeful and how disingenuous many were being. And that's not to say that all of the people that were doing that were disingenuous people. It's because a new norm had been set.
Right.
And I think that in cultures and society, I think there's moments in which people need to step forwards, throw the brakes on, and question things that are becoming normal.
Right.
Obviously. And I mean, it's arguing about credit now and, you know, starting the credit revolution, it all seems a bit silly now that the world is shut down from a pandemic. But, you know, I don't regret screaming and shouting about it back in December at all. It seemed very important back then.
Yeah. Well, I think it's I think you bring up some excellent points, but I do, you know, we're come up to an hour and there's something we were talking about, you know, before we started the podcast, and an email saying that, you know, this has obviously been a struggle for us to deal with this new normal, the pandemic normal.
Yeah.
And I think we're finding new ways to deal with it. But one thing that you also do that I want to make sure we talk about so that people can find out about it is to help with your own self-soothing or self-meditation is your music, right?
I write and record a lot of music. It became very important to me. I'm 6 years sober this July.
Wow.
Congratulations.
Thank you. This profession can be very stressful.
Yep.
And I kind of went down a dark lane. You know, I used to numb myself. you know, a little bit more, you know, could hurt one's health, I guess, than Instagram does. But another numbing, you know, I was numbing myself from the stresses. And yeah, I write and record music, as part of my kind of ongoing therapy. And, you know, I'm releasing a new double album, hopefully in the next couple of months. It's mastered, finished. I've made three videos. It's all ready to go. It's just that
that's awesome.
It's you know, obviously right now is very busy, kind of stabilizing ships, etc. at D-Box.
I'm right.
Just waiting until I got a bit of a breather to let the new one out of the door. But it's it's a concept album that basically it starts on New Year's Day in 2012. With the first track, which is New Year's Day on 2012, where I promised myself that I would never drink again, and I made it till about 7 o'clock that night, and that's the opening track. And then the last track is called The Beautiful Fear, which is actually about all the characters that I met in rehab in 2016.
Wow.
And I'm very proud of it. It's for me, the music is, you know, to close the circle is very much, you know, the clientless creative, you know,
right.
This double album I'm releasing is my, you know, the third and the seventh. It's got that much of my, it's got absolutely everything that I have creatively funneled into a piece of music that's 122 minutes long.
That's a long album. That is a double album for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I started, although the first track, as I just described, is in the narrative, starts in 2012. Actually, one of the songs on the record, I actually started writing back in 2010. So this album has basically been 10 years in the making.
Right.
Wow, that's awesome.
Yeah, it's a lot of very early mornings and late evenings and a very understanding wife.
Well, that is amazing. So you said it's going to be out at some point in the next few months, and this podcast will be out probably in about a month or maybe 6 weeks.
Yeah, you can like you can find the if you're interested in finding the music. I go under the name The Beautiful Fear.
The Beautiful Fear. Okay.
Yeah, and in short, that is an expression I made up to describe the challenges one goes through in order to actually change yourself for the better.
Right.
Absolutely terrifying, but also at the same time can be beautiful if you manage to pull it off.
Yeah. That's great. So Beautiful Fear would be a good place to do it. But would love to, if you know, when the album comes out, we will make sure to put it up on the podcast page so people can check it out.
Oh, I'd really appreciate that, Chris. It's very kind of you.
Yeah, for sure. That's really cool. So I appreciate all of your input. I think this is a really good podcast. Oh. A lot of things for people to grasp onto and to think about in terms of their work and the work that they do and how they're influenced by other people, as well as, you know, what they're giving people credit for what they're doing, as well as finding ways to deal with their stresses in their lives. And I think there's lots of things that people can do. And I think music is a great way for sure.
Yeah, well, thanks so much for having me on. I was kind of terrified to do this, as you probably recall.
Yeah, I don't see why. You were great.
I procrastinated you, but I guess this has been a lot of fun.
Yeah, for sure. Now, you know, I was going to tell you this. Hold on. I
unfortunately your video is not working right now, but that's okay. We will figure it out. But I do need a selfie from you, because what I'm going to do is I'm going to take a picture of you, and then I'm going to take my phone, and I'm going to take the picture that you take of me, and I'm going to put it onto this device, and it's going to spit out a Polaroid. And that is going to go on our wall of podcast guests. So,
so you just want me to take a selfie?
Yes. And then send something fun. Yeah. Something fun, selfie, very, as you know, as fun and personable as you'd like it to be. If you want to pose with a guitar or headphones or whatever makes you feel like, you know, we were hanging out together, that would be
okay.
That
cool.
Would be great.
I have a little marionette puppet that I might pose with.
Nice. I love it.
Perfect. It's a little mini me.
That's perfect. Thank you so much, Matthew. Really appreciate it.
All right. Cheers. And thank you very much.